Imagine you were seeing this person casually. You're a party animal. You're going out doing whatever you want with whoever you wanted, whenever you wanted. And then all of a sudden you find out the news. I'm pregnant. But you decide, okay, I'm going to suck it up. I'm going to be a man. I'm going to start raising my son for 2 years. And then you hear whispers from the family saying, I think you should get a paternity test. Huh? Why would they say that? And it had already been like a challenging relationship. You weren't even together, but you're doing it for the good of your son. And then finally, you get a paternity test and you find out they're not yours. How do you deal with that? Oh, you'll find out on this podcast. You've had quite an adverse experience through life that you overcame and hope to inspire others to do it. But where are you from originally, brother? Where are you born, my friend?
I'm born in Cape Town, South Africa. Lived there for the first 21 years of my life. And, then went and did a bit of traveling and stayed abroad for a few years. And then went back to South Africa for another 10. And then decided to leave. So you can do the maths.
Yeah.
Old I am.
Yeah. We won't do the math. You look 20, surely, if I math that right. Yeah. But the one thing, all I know about Cape Town is those sharks like to jump out of the water, mate. Have you ever tried to not look like a seal when you went swimming, or did you not swim?
I think I restricted my swimming to a pool, really, for that very reason. So, if I'm on the beach, it's on the sand. And if I'm swimming, it's in a pool.
Yeah, smart man. Yeah. You're a wise man. What's life like in Cape Town? You know, obviously we've got misguided views on it. I've heard periods where it was amazing, periods where it was petrifying.
Yeah.
What would you say?
I guess once you're living in it, you don't see what others see because you're in it. I grew up pretty normal. You know, there was a bit of danger here and there, as there is everywhere in the world. And then as I grew up, you know, just wanted to see a bit more, wanted to experience a bit more than my neighborhood and my city. Because at that point, I haven't even left, I hadn't left Cape Town at all. And I thought there's got to be more than this. And then decided to go traveling. But growing up, it was okay. And then obviously going back to South Africa, that's when I started realizing that this is not normal. What we consider to be normal is not normal. You know, locking your windows and doors with burglar bars and gates, and it's just not, you know, having your head constantly on a swivel. It's that's not how you're supposed to live life. But like I said, growing up, you know, we just kind of accepted things that this is how it is and that's how we go. And yeah.
Was there any close calls? Anything that went down and you're like, oh, if you didn't have a swivel head, it would have got messy?
Well, I mean, nothing really in the first half of it. Kind of just saw things that people spoke about and thought, oh, okay, so that's how that goes down. But the second stanza in South Africa, I was held at gunpoint in my face. Well, not in my face, but I was held with a gun in my face as they were busy robbing the store. And for me, that was just like, okay, it's time to go. You know, Cape Town's lovely and all, but yeah, when things like that happen, you know, you kind of just, because I always knew I was going to leave South Africa again and go somewhere else and travel. But, you know, that kind of forced my hand when that happened. And I just thought, this is not how this is supposed to go down. And I think within 4 months of that event, I made up my mind. And the fifth month, I was gone. So yeah.
Wow. Were you buying like Twinkies or something and someone just came in? Or like what?
Literally going to buy a 2 liter Coke. Literally going to buy a 2 liter Coke. And walking to the shop, saw people lying on the floor. And I thought, that's odd. And the next thing I looked up, I was like, wow, okay, sure. You know, so that was like, yeah. And then I was like, okay, right. Yeah, that's it for me. I'm not going to stay around any longer and wait for something to happen.
That's wild. Yeah, because you think you walk in the store and you wouldn't see people lying down. You'd be like, oh, this is empty. I'm going to get my 2 liter Coke real quick. And yeah. Then next minute, there's a guy. Where were they hiding? Where did you spot them?
They were standing, like, when you came into the shop, they were standing like normal people would stand in a little, like a little supermarket thing. They were just standing like normal people would stand, and you wouldn't think anything of it because there's always people standing around in a supermarket as they do, looking at things. And so you don't, you know, you don't register. You just walk in and you're just like, oh yeah, I need to get myself a Coke. Where's a Coke? Shit. Okay. Yeah, I guess. You know, so that for me was, and then obviously I got pointed to go and lay on the ground with everybody else. And I just thought to myself, this is not how what I had envisioned. And this is not how I want to go down. So, yeah, I've got to make a plan now. And 5 months, I was gone.
And then you die of diabetes instead of a gunpoint because of all the Coke you drink.
Actually, I do have diabetes.
There you go. That's your bigger risk. You can go back to Cape Town, bro. That's what's coming for you.
Yeah. No, I got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2013. The funny thing is, that's the fittest I've ever been in my life at that point. And that's when I was like diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And it was a kick in the guts because obviously you're playing sport. I was playing sport 6 out of 7 days a week at that point. I was playing squash, rugby, tennis, you know, just getting into it, getting any sport I can. And but doing a bit of gymming and crossfitting as well. And got hit with this news that I'm a type 1 diabetic. And I was like, oh, whatever, it's not for me. It'll pass like everything else. And then 6 weeks later, I got really ill. And I went back to the doctor and he was like, question, have you been taking the medication? And straight out, I said, what medication? And he said, oh, clearly then you haven't been taking it. And I go, well, I'm not sick. I'm fine. I'm fit. And he's like, yeah, you need to take better care of your health. And he explained everything to me and sat me down. Because I thought I was going to die at that point, like, you know, the way they portrayed diabetes. I thought I was going to die. And he just explained it to me, broke it down, and then obviously made more sense. And I went to a diabetes clinic where they explain things to you and show you how to do things. And then obviously my journey just continued from there onwards.
So there's one where you eat too much sugar and it's environmental, and then one that's like kind of like genetic where you need to eat sugar, yeah, otherwise you faint. What's type 1? Explain it to the ignorant ones like me.
That's all right. So type 1 is where your pancreas decides to go on a permanent holiday. So it doesn't manufacture any insulin, and that's why you've got to inject the insulin on a daily basis, 3 times, 4 times a day, depending on what device you've got. Type 2 diabetes is the diabetes that is done by diet. So, you know, not eating the wrong foods, not eating sugar, and that's where you lose limbs quicker because your diet is like, you've literally got your diet in your own hands. So that's the difference between the two mainly. One's controlled by diet and the other one's controlled by insulin.
There was like a picture I saw like in the 1930s and it was something like, these 1,000 pigs have been used to make insulin, one vial of insulin. Yeah. Some stupid. I didn't think I'd talk about diabetes on the show. I thought we were going to talk about how you used to be a gangster or something like that. I didn't know what your hardship was, brother.
It's all good. It's part of life. It just, you know, adds to the flavor of something that was. I wouldn't say, because I actually thought about this and I was thinking, how would I put this? With me, we didn't grow up not having, but we also grew up not having, if you understand what I mean. So there was a lot of things that other kids had that we never had. But we never went to bed, obviously, without food for one night of my life. There was always at least food on our table. But there were times when it was really tough. You know, we couldn't go on school outings, couldn't get new shoes, couldn't get new clothes, had to wait, you know, just like all the other kids in our neighborhood. And, you know, there was certain times where you wanted certain things and you just couldn't have them. There was just no way possible that you were going to have that. And you'd either have to wait or steal to get it. And, you know, obviously,
you're not with very the patient.
I'm not a patient person, but there was a few times when I did a few wrong things, but it's all because I wanted to fit in and I wanted to be cool and I wanted to have things. And, you know, obviously, my parent wasn't always by the means to do that. So, yeah.
What was your biggest heist? What was your biggest heist? 4 liters of Coke, or what'd you go for? What was your...
It was more things like going to places and not paying, like sneaking through the back, walking into a supermarket, taking what you want. One person keep the cashier busy, the other person's taking stuff, and you know, those kind of stupid little things that you do.
What's your top tips? Also, what's your look?
No.
Self-checkout order of the week. That'd be easy.
Yeah, so it was just the thing was, my parents split when I was quite young. I think I was 11. My parents got divorced, and then my dad died when I was 12. And then my mom got remarried, and I didn't get along with that guy. And I got shipped off to boarding school at 12. So obviously, boarding school is a whole different jungle, and it comes with its own set of challenges because you stuck in a house with teenage boys between the age of 13 and 18 or 13 and 20. So, you know, you've got to learn to survive there. And then also the whole racial integration thing was taking place at that time as well, because there were certain schools you weren't allowed to go to. And then the doors kind of opened and you were allowed to go to school there. And then there's different cultures and different languages and different, you know, different sorts of like a melting pot of cultures and people, and you've got to learn to get along. And obviously there's a lot of fighting, a lot of misunderstanding and things like that. But
were the white boys outnumbered in that school?
Oh yeah, like I mean
yeah. Did they get wrecked?
There was three of, I think there was maybe four of us, you know, that were not white in the boarding house. And, you know, oftentimes I was quite small as well. I wasn't big or tall. I was quite skinny and small. So I got picked on quite a bit. And obviously, coming where I'm from, you can't allow that. You know, so I would often get into fights over something really stupid because I wanted to prove myself. And I, like I said, once again, the cultural differences, you know, like for us, it's go out and get it. And for my friends, it was more like, wait and it'll come to you. So, you know, I didn't understand that concept. And yeah, with me being impatient and all, I often just, you know, there's a system, there's a way of doing things. And like, for example, when I started going to boarding school, I could only eat with a fork because that's all I knew. We never sat at the table. We used to put your food in your lap and you eat with a fork. So you hold the plate and you eat with a fork. So.
Oh, and then you're just like cupping it. I was like, fuck.
No.
Pretty hot, bro. I was like, can't even get a plate. Times are bleak. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so, you said one fork. Yeah, no manners.
Yeah, and you know, so then going to boarding school, you've got to eat with a knife and a fork, and your elbows off the table and things like that. And you're not used to it, you know, so you're sitting with your elbows on the table, hand on your head and forking, and they're like, what are you doing? And you're like, what do you mean? I'm eating. And they go, no, you've got to put your elbows down. You've got to eat with a knife. I'm like, but I don't want to eat with a knife. I'll eat with a fork. I'm like, no, you've got to take the fork and knife and you got to eat. And then you got to switch the hands. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to keep the fork in the other hand because that's what you say. I'm going to do it because I want it and I feel this is comfortable. So there was the little things like that you used to get used to. And then obviously, you know, like, reaching over someone to get something instead of saying, could you pass me that? So there was like just things like that that you had to not, you had to get accustomed to, like a bell ringing to put you to sleep, a bell ringing to wake you up in the morning, a bell ringing to get your food, a bell ringing to go to get you to go to school. So, you know, all those kind of things, it took some getting used to. And then going home, it wasn't pleasant either because my stepdad and I just did not get along at all. So, you know, there was that. And then
you get the two piece in the soda.
You guys get
into it? We fight. Were you guys like had altercations?
Yeah. The last altercation we had, I ended up running for my life. Because he pulled out a gun, he was going to shoot me. So, I had to run, literally run for my life that day.
Did you get the coke that was, time too?
No, what was I after then? No, just kidding. So it was just about something, some stupid chore he had me, wanted me to do, and I just wasn't going to do it because, you know, I was rebellious and I didn't want to do it. And then we ended up grabbing each other and I shoved him and he had a cast on his leg. And then the next thing I know, I'm looking down the passage and I just see this dude coming and I'm like, oh shit, he's got something in his hand. And that's when I just ran and jumped the wall at the back. And then, yeah, that was the end of my life at home. I got kicked out of our house. I think the first year of high school, I got kicked out. Second year of high school, I got kicked out. Third year, fourth year, fifth year. So constantly just getting kicked out of house, bouncing between cousins and sisters and things like that, you know, just to have a place to stay. And then obviously going back to boarding school. So that wasn't pleasant. And, you know, I always said, look, when I'm an adult one day, that's not the type of person I'm going to be. And, you know, I just also, a lot of it, there was financial constraints, not being able to have something, not being able to do something. And then I think I got to 15 and I started working because I wanted things and my mother couldn't afford it. And I was sick of waiting. So started working, started buying my own stuff. And then obviously with that, you've got to contribute with your pay to the house, you know, so whatever you pay, you got to give your money. Or that's how it used to be, at least. You've got to give your money to your parents and they give you spending money and things. So
what was the job? What was your first job apart from stealing? Because that's an occupation.
I worked at a butcher. And I don't know if you've ever put a sheep, four sheep or three sheep across your back.
He's heavy.
No joke.
For a little fella, it's huge.
Yeah, so you've got one ear, and one behind your neck. And you've got to trot along with those three things on your shoulders. But, yeah, that was the start of it. And I just remember having the money, buying what I wanted. But also that didn't last very long because you don't know the value of money. You have it now and you want things like new sneakers and the latest starter jackets and the latest starter caps and, you know, Levi jeans and all these things. And, before you know it, your money's over. And then, I think before I turned 21, my mom sat me down and she said, look, the next few years are going to be the golden years of your life. You know, go out there, have fun. If you can look after your money, but I only heard the have fun part. I didn't hear about to look after your money and mature or nothing. All I heard was like, you know, go out and have fun. So growing up between 21 and about 32, I just literally had fun. I partied, I traveled, went to some wild parties, met some cool people, and I basically worked to fund my habit of partying. So, you know, whatever money I get, I didn't put anything away. I was just worried about what we're going to do the weekend, where we're going, what party we're going to attend, you know, what clothes am I going to get? So, looking back at it now, it's obviously like, with all that, you could have done so much. But then I guess that's part of the learning curve. You know, that's part of learning
Did you have a system when you went out? So let's say, so did you have a process? So obviously girls are involved, or guys, I shouldn't make assumptions, or non-binaries, shout out to them. What's your strategy back in the day? You're like, okay, I want to find my future wife, obviously, just one woman. What would you do to get dressed and to get in the zone, and how would you start a conversation for these young bucks trying to find love?
Well, the thing was, I wasn't looking to find the wife because I didn't want to be tied down. That's the whole thing with partying. I don't think any self-respecting woman is going to want to date a party animal that just wants to party, 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 party all the time. Based on that, I didn't want to have a wife or something. And I just wanted to do my own thing. I just wanted to party without strings, and I just wanted to go wherever I wanted to go without having to ask for permission. Well, not ask for permission, but, you know, like, hey, I'm going here, or hey, we're going to do this. And I just want to do, if someone says, we're going to Ministry of Sound this weekend, yep, I'm in. We're going to Passion this weekend, yep, I'm in. We're going for a boys trip to Holland, yep, I'm in. I know with, if you have a girlfriend or a wife, you know, you'd have to be like, hey, babe, listen, I want to go here. The guys are going here. What do you think, you know?
But, let's have a break.
I didn't want that. For me, basically, to an extent, I do say go out and enjoy yourself and have fun, because there comes a time for being serious. There comes a time for making some big decisions, you know, like buying a home, settling down, having a family, things like that. So those decisions will come your way, and you'll have to make them at some point. You know, don't feel pressured, because there's obviously a lot of my friends were pressured. You know, the parents are like, hey, listen, you can't be doing this forever. You need to settle down, and we found a nice girl for you, and we think you should meet her. And that was them. You know, the next thing you know, you get an engagement invite, and then the next thing you're a best man in a wedding. So, you know, those kind of things. And for me, I just wanted to party. I just wanted to really enjoy myself to the point where I have had enough, and I don't want to do this anymore. And then I want to settle down, and I want to buy a house, and I want to get married, those kind of things. So, I mean, for the youngsters out there, have fun, but, you know, at some point you're going to have to make some serious decisions. Don't leave it too long, because obviously we're not getting any younger. We're just getting older. The younger you start, the better it is. Now, that advice is not for everybody, because some people start later in life. Some people have goals like traveling first, and things like that. For some people who grow up in a family-based system, family is important to them, so they're not going to party. They're just going to jump straight into it and have families. But my advice would be to, you know, to have a balance. Have fun by all means, but at the same time, also be mindful that you have to make certain big decisions for your life ahead.
Yeah, and don't get someone pregnant. Great advice. I like that. By accident.
Yeah. Because kids are a big responsibility, man. I mean, I had my first child at 36. And by that time I was ready. Like, I don't want to go clubbing. I don't want to go to parties. I don't want to belong to the streets. You know, I had my first child at 36, my second at 38. And I was ready for that. You know, I was prepared. Like, I knew, there's going to be some long nights. There's going to be some little sleeping. I'm going to have to work for them now, and it's no longer about me. And I've got a lot of friends who also got married when they were quite young, talking about 22, 23. They are now divorced. They are now in the clubs. You know, they are now chasing that youth that they missed out on when some of us were doing these things. You know, so that's why I say it's so important to find that balance. So that you're not still wanting to chase the wrong things in life, but actually wanting to, you know, like now, we're supposed to be, at this age, you're supposed to be kind of enjoying your family, making plans for the future, looking at what, you know, the next 20 years look like, things like that, and not, you know, running around in town trying to keep up with the youngsters.
Do you think there was like a hole I was trying to fill? Because I used to do that. I went out like every night for 6 months in a row. And I was like, traveled 4 years, worked 8 weeks, and just did whatever I wanted when I wanted, woke up when I wanted, had fun with whoever. Well, not whoever I wanted. If they wanted me, then yes, we had fun. But
yeah,
what it was filling a hole for me. It was a fear of vulnerability and a fear of commitment. What do you think you were masking with the lifestyle that you're living?
I think I was trying to make up for the fact that I didn't have a teen years, or that I didn't have like my younger years, because obviously when my parents got divorced, I was now the man in my mom's house, you know, so I had to step up, make sure my brother's taken care of, make sure that things get done around the house, because I was now in the place of my dad. And then when my mom got involved with my stepdad, he then took over that role. And then my dad died, you know, so then I was fatherless, so to speak. So then I had to kind of just mature really quickly, because then the crowd I started hanging with were 10 years older than me, 10, 15 years older than me. But because they found me mature enough to be in their company, they always just used to drag me along. And that's when I obviously, you don't get to be a child. You don't get to go to teenage parties. You don't get to hang out with your teenage friends, because your friends that you know as friends are all 10 years, 15 years older than you. So you don't have that, you know, youth where you get to be silly and laugh and talk about girls and how, you know, funny little things you do in high school. I didn't have that. You know, for me, it was straight from primary school into adulthood. And then when I... And obviously, with my parents being strict Christians, we weren't allowed to go clubbing. We weren't allowed to go to parties. We weren't allowed to have sleepovers. We woke up at 7 on school holidays in the morning, up at 7, and in bed by 9:30, school holidays, doesn't matter when. And every day you're mopping floors. Every day you're doing dishes. Every day you're cleaning a house, picking up dog poo. So, you know, you just don't get a chance. You almost like you're in a concentration camp. And when I left home, at 18, that for me was like, right now, it's my turn. This is my turn now. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I still couldn't do it, you know, like I wanted to do, because my mom was always, you know, I was living with family members or living with other church people. So I kind of still had to watch what I was doing. So church, I was maybe allowed to go to a party now, but I couldn't sleep out, you know, type thing. Or maybe now I could go to something, but I still have to be home because these people know my parents. And my mother would always ask them, what's he up to, you know, and they go, oh, no, he's all right. Or, oh, no, he's, you know, he's misbehaving. So I still didn't really get a chance to express myself. And then 21, I just got my own place. And that's also when I started talking to my mom quite a bit, because she and I also didn't have a good relationship. After my dad died, we fought like cat and dog. And because she got married to another man who's not my dad, and there was all, we never got along. We never sat around one fire. And about 16, 17 years old, we sat down and we started talking like adults. And, you know, I explained to her why I was upset and why I did the things I did. And, she explained to me her situation, and we kind of got to a path where we understood each other. But when I turned 21, I like had my own house and everything that I was renting. And that's when I just went nuts. Like we partied from Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, rest and repeat. you know, so we used to get, one very vivid memory is that we used to go from the club to my work with my clothes in the boot, and I would get changed in the work in the parking lot at work, and then go into work in the morning, and then come out the afternoon, hook up with my friends again, go home for an hour, sleep, wash, and repeat the cycle. So, I did that for a while, you know, and it was something where I was really good, and I was enjoying myself with friends, you know, we were always together. We were drinking, you know, we were going to parties and everything was just great. I thought, this is the life. this is where I'm at. This is where I want to be. And by the time I got to 25, 26, I was like, oh, I probably should start looking at, you know, doing certain other, like probably start looking at getting a house or looking at getting a girlfriend or, and I was like, ah, nah, let's go party. So, you know, just be, nah, not going to do that. And then, you know, carried on partying and then had girlfriends in between, but, you know, nothing really sticks when you've got that kind of lifestyle. So, yeah, just carried on partying, left the UK, went back to South Africa, carried on partying there. And then I got involved with a, lady and, we slept together a few times and she then said that, I'm the father of the child that she's having. And I mean, by this time I was like maybe 30, 31 and I thought, well, it won't be too bad, can it? You know, I'm like 30, 31, having a child now. I kind of know, you know, what's expected of me. I do like children. And I thought, okay, you know what? Yeah. And I was like, okay, so what do we do? Where do we go from here? And she said, well, you know, you've got to father your child. And I was like, okay. I said, I don't want to be with you, but I will father the child if that's okay. And she was like, yeah, well, I don't want to be with you either. And I was like, sweet, seven arrangement.
Do you reckon she said that in response? Or that was her thought before you brought it up?
No, I think she said that in response because up until that point, everything was okay. And then I broke that one out. Oof. And then, yeah, that didn't end well for me. and then, obviously, as time goes on, there were just some things that just didn't make sense. And me being infatuated with being a father and, you know, having a son.
Was it a white baby? Is he...
No, it was
Asian.
No, she was a colored girl as well.
Yeah.
But she was very fair, so obviously the child was fair too.
I feel like you're gonna break a bombshell. Sorry, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, so there were just a few things that didn't add up, and she just wanted more money and wanted more things. And I said, well, from the get go, I'm not giving you any money. I'll buy whatever I need to buy: clothes, nappies, whatever. I'll do all that, but I'm not giving you physical money. I don't trust you. I won't give you physical money. I'll do everything else I have to. And then she tried to take me to court 1 month for not giving physical money. And I explained to the court that we had an arrangement. And her sister came to me and said, buddy, you're a nice guy and we really like you. You should go and have a paternity test. And I said, why would I want to do that? You know, she wouldn't go down that road with me, would she? And they said, well, we're not going to say anything, but we just suggest that you do that.
Read between the lines. Fuck yeah.
Yeah. And then I was like, wait, what's going on now? And they were like, just pay attention to what we're saying to you. And I was like, okay. And I grappled with it for a bit, and then I called and I was like, hey, just out of interest, like, is that my child? And she goes, what the hell kind of question is that? And I was like, well, yeah, I just want to know. So do you consent to a paternity test? And she went, no, why would I do that? And I was like, well, I don't know, but I'm going to request a paternity test. So whether you want to do it or not, it's coming your way. So I went to court and explained my situation. And the judge then ordered a paternity test. And she was upset. She took me to court. And
wait, how old was the baby? How old was the...
The child was about maybe, I think, 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
2 years old or almost 2 years old. And then, long story short, we went to court, got the result, not my child. And this being when he was 6 days old, I had a tattoo done on my chest. And she was there when the tattoo was done. So, you know, when he kind of read out the result, I just said to her, like, how could you? How could you do that? She didn't have an answer for me. And then the judge said to me, would you like to sue for, you know,
Child support.
everything that you've, yeah, for everything that you've done? And I said, no, I think this is punishment enough for her. That she's got to live with what she's done. So, you know,
Oof.
I said, actually, this is a blessing in disguise, you know, because that means that I don't have to have any ties with you
Yeah, you get
whatsoever.
party
And
again.
I can move on with my life, and just, you know, not have to worry about shared weekends and stuff like that.
Jesus.
So yeah, then
You
carried
go.
on parting. Yeah, carried on parting for a bit, but then, you know, there was just like, surely there's got to be more than this. And I'm not designed for working and just going home and being depressed about my situation. And because eventually it started taking a toll on me, you know, because people start asking you like, hey, where's your kid? Hey, how's your kid doing? You know, and you got to either not tell them the story or, you know, just tell them the story all over again. So it got to a point where I was starting to get really like, you know, depressed about it. And just try to party more, and it just wasn't working out because no matter how hard you party, this was just not going away. And work was also at a point where I was just stagnating. I wasn't getting any promotions. I wasn't getting any new projects. I was just in the contact center, just there. And I thought to myself, oh man, I've got to do something more. Surely this is not it. And funny enough, that's around the same time that the hijacking happened, which then forced me into making a few decisions and talking to a few people, about what I want to do and what my intentions are. And we ended up in New Zealand. So yeah, 5 months later, I jumped on a plane, my passport,
Come in.
and yeah, that was it.
What's so I don't know if you've seen this show on TikToks, like You Are Not the Father. Have you ever come across those TikToks? Right, and then the guy just starts dancing or whatever. But I imagine that was not how it was. What when you found that out, because the brain must do something to you when you think it's your child, and it may, and then you invest in it, and then you also got the trauma bond of the relationship you had and how confusing and misleading. What was that like when you found out what went through your mind, like that sense of betrayal and being able to trust someone again, and what was it like?
I had a very like when they announced the news, and I was like, how could you do this? I didn't, there was no tears, there was no like shock or anything. I was just like, you know, calm, straight faced, like, how could you do this? And you know, when he announced, do you want to sue for anything? I just said, no, I think this is punishment enough. And we walked out of the courtroom, and I just said to her, like, what made you think that doing this was okay? I said, you're a horrible human being, you know? And I walked away, and then I called my mom, and I was like, hey, so got the results. This is the outcome. And she was like rejoicing. She's like, Kenan, this means you can start over, and this is now the start of your new life, and don't mess it up, and da 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 da. And this is how God has worked for you, and you now gotta, you know, look after yourself and don't just, you know, be with anybody. And she gave me the whole speech, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I suppose. But when it hit me was when people started asking, like, hey, how's Jude doing? Or hey, when last you see Jude? And the news hadn't broken because I hadn't told anybody, as a matter of fact, except my mom. You know, not even my close friends knew what was going on. So like eventually I had to start coming out with this information that it was not my son. And that's when it started hitting me, because now people are asking you, like, and they're innocently asking, because you've paraded this child in front of them for 2 years of your life. You've paraded this child, you've showed them this child, and they've seen you with this child, and now you're not there. The child's not there. So obviously they're just innocently asking you, like, hey, what happened? Where's Jude? Or her, my daughter's having a birthday party for, can you bring Jude? And I'm like, yeah, I can't. And they're like, why not? And I was like, oh man, I'll tell you again. So you can only use that so many times. I'll tell you again, or I'll explain it again,
Oh.
but in my dramas. But at some point you eventually have to grapple with it, and people come to you and they go, oh man, you've been saying this for the last 3 weeks now, and yeah, something's up. What's going on? And you've got to go, hey, look, man, find out he's not my son. And they go, what? How? And and then it's like, oh shit, I've got to go explain this whole thing over again, and yeah, so that took a toll on me. And then you go to the doctor, you're not feeling great, you get sick and you don't want to go to work, and the doctor just wants to give you antidepressants. And I'm like, yeah, nah, I'm not doing that stuff, guy, sorry. Because I read up about it and spoke to a few people that were on it, and I was like, that's not me. I'm not gonna do that. I'm gonna just do whatever else I can, but I'm not doing that. So yeah, the more I started talking about it, the more it kind of started getting out of my system, and everybody knew. And then my close friends, obviously, they were there quite a bit. So my mom, she was there, checking up on me, making sure I'm okay, reminding me that I'm now free, to do whatever I want to do and to carry on with my life, and I have a fresh start. And with some of my friends, they've had baby mama dramas, and things like that. And she's like, you're free of that now. You can go and do whatever you like. And then my mom said, I wish that you would just maybe go overseas and do something different. And I said, why? She's like, oh, well, there's nothing here for you. You're just gonna get up to mischief. And I thought, she's probably right. But anyway, I wouldn't tell her that. But then, like I said, events just folded in a way. We either had to make some hard decisions, and then decided to come to New Zealand, and that is a decision I do not regret at all, and I hold on to with both hands.
Boom. Was that the last time you saw your pretend son? I don't know what you call them. But like the
Yeah, that
courtroom, you're just
was.
like, boom, didn't look at him. It's later, bowl. He'll forget me too. Like, did you say goodbye or?
No, I won. I think maybe 3 months before I left, I called her up and I said, hey, I need to see him because I'm leaving South Africa, and I need to get that out of my system. And she said, what do you mean? I said, can I just see him, yes or no? And she said, yes, you can. I was like, okay, fine. And I think he spent the weekend with me that weekend, or that time he spent the weekend with me. And the whole time I'm just in my mind, I'm like, you're going to be okay. This child's going to be okay. And this is probably for the best. Like, I've got to cut ties with this child for my own sanity, as well as, for him, because I was the only person he knew up until that point. So, that weekend, I kind of like, just made peace with her that this is it. And I said to her the Sunday that I dropped him off, I said, hey, so I'm leaving, for New Zealand, and I won't be coming back, and, I'd appreciate it if you don't tell him about me, because you're going to confuse him. He's got his real father. Tell him who his real father is and raise him with his real family.
Oh,
But
does
don't
she
ignore.
know? Does she know who the father is?
Yeah, she knew.
She
She
knew all
knew.
along.
She knew.
It wasn't like a
She knew
timing
all
thing,
along.
like two guys in a week or whatever.
No. This was she planned this thing out meticulously.
Oh, so she was pre-pregnant before you got together. Buns are in the
Yeah.
oven.
She planned this
Bruh.
thing very meticulously. And the thing
It's
is,
a compliment because it means she picked you as
well,
the.
the thing was, she was involved in a lot of wrong stuff. And she had money to burn. And I was after the money, not after her. And that's where I got caught up, because all I saw was the money. I didn't pay attention to what she was doing. I didn't pay attention to who she was. All I saw was the money. We're going to flash places, eating at flash places, doing flash things. And I failed to notice what was really happening. But obviously she had planned this way in advance and knew exactly what she was doing when she got involved with me. And obviously I only found that out towards the end.
How is she making money? Well, mate, you don't have to say explicitly, but not good means. Like what?
No.
There's so many genres that could be. And you're just like, oh, she's rich. She's not that attractive. I don't like her that much. But, you know, I need to party.
Well, she was attractive, but that wasn't, like, I was more after the money and, like, we were having good times, the party, again. Having good times, partying, you know, like, we want to buy a bottle of Jack Daniels, boom. You want to buy a bottle of Ciroc, boom. You want to buy this, boom. You know, everything is just, nothing
Sugar
was an
mama.
Issue.
Was she older?
Yeah. No, she was younger. So, you know, running after money and seeing the good times, I failed to see a lot of things that was happening, and I didn't, you know, I didn't question it.
So was she pregnant before she met you?
No, she, like, we knew each other because we kind of worked together, so we knew who each other was. And then obviously we started talking this and that and this and that. And then,
like, what was the plan? You know what I mean? Like, what was the strategy? So she'd just go randomly try and, you know, get herself pregnant and then blame it on you? Or what was the strat? Like, she was already pregnant?
Nah, I think she wanted to get out of her current situation. Because she was separated or something and she wanted to get out of her situation completely. But I don't think that worked because she was pregnant. So, you know, she then had to make up a plan, make up a scheme. And I came along. And then she's like, sweet, gotta get this guy.
the exit plan. So you were the parachute.
Yeah. That's and cool. It went really bad for her. Even before we found out about him not being my son. Things went really south for her. Like, I'm talking about bad. And I was like, I'm not going to help you. You know, our family cut her off and yeah, there was some hairy times for her. And, the last I heard, she was in a rehab. So yeah.
Wow.
That was that.
Well, we're actually at the end of our time together, but what would be, something apart from these horrific tragedies and betrayals of your life that someone's either been betrayed or is at a financial position where they see there's no hope, what would you say to them as a leaving remark to hopefully give them courage?
I'd say just hold on. You know, things do get better. Just keep your head down. Because I thought about this as well. What would you say to someone? And my advice would be simple. Keep your head down and your situation will change. You know, just do what you have to do. Your situation will change. But if you're, you know, looking for, like I was looking for quick money, I was looking to get out of my circumstances, you know, I was looking in all the wrong places for all the wrong things. Whereas, you know, if I'd maybe keep my head down, worked and just been patient, things would have turned out differently. But because I wasn't patient, you know, and I just wanted things. I went through unnecessary things that I could have avoided if I was just patient. And if I kept my head down and just, did what I had to.
That was an insane story. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah. No, that's all good. That's all good. Like I said, you know, sometimes there's one or two people that will pull inspiration from something you say or from learn a lesson from something that you've been through. So hopefully there's someone out there that will go, actually, that guy's story motivated me to do something better. Well, I don't want to do that because I don't want to end up in that situation.
I agree with that. Wow, yeah. Well done. Thank you.